Hey everybody, welcome to the Helping Friendly Podcast. We are back here for episode 123. With us once again is Wally Waxbanks.
It's great that we were able to get twice, 2 weeks apart, for this conversation.
Wally is the official authority on Fall 97 because he wrote a book on it called A Tiny Space to Move and Breathe, which is awesome. Wally suggested, I think, this twist from November 14th, but you could pick a number of them, and I mean, it's impossible to overstate the importance of this tour. I don't know, Brad.
Right. I think I mentioned it last episode. It's a little weird that we haven't fallen on like some pretty staple, established Fall 97 jams, 12-6, 12-7, 11, 12, you know, like all those really great shows that we go back to a lot, or at least I go back to a lot. And this is kind of the beginning of it. It's even before 11-17-97, which is an epic first set, that I can't get enough of even to this day. So I think it's a great choice by Wally to, take us to kind of the beginning of what is really kind of December 97, I guess, that we all love, except for the 11-17 show. This is it's a 4-song second set, Piper into Twist, which is kind of, you know, something that just, like reminds me of sitting in front of a fire, like on a bear rug, you know, Piper into Twist, man. Like, it's like so warm and wonderful. Yeah. Just, I love it. What is this 15 minutes of just greatness? So Wally, why is this to you of Fall 97? The point you wanted to point out.
I would say that the Stash Jam from Vegas the night before offers a glimpse of a color or texture or mood that I don't think they had been able to produce and stay with previously. That I think they had to get small, and they had to really dig into the minimalism that the end of 1996 was making available to them, and that they've been exploring all throughout the first half of 97. And they get to the E Center, and that is the prevailing mood. And instead of it just being a color that was used for effect, instead of like having one, we're going to play some frantic music, and we're going to play some stately music, and we're going to play some martial music. Then we're going to have this odd sort of ambient passage in the middle of a Stash, of all places. Stash is a very busy, bothered song. It's an agitated song. Instead, they're going to be languid and sparse and austere and haunted. And that is that kind of spooky mood. This is the first time when it becomes a destination instead of a passage to a big pop at the end or something. And to me, it's so peaceful. I've talked about this on the podcast before, actually. It's so peaceful and so timeless. That feeling of timelessness. That certain kinds of chemical vacations can also produce, of being outside of the flow of time, and to be in a pool of time with other people floating in it.
Thank you.
there's two things that I think maybe lend to your point for me. Number one is the wah pedal and the kind of, you know, the muted strings and just the, you know, like that Trey was so adept at by the end of Fall 97. And then the second thing is, I don't even know what it is actually, because my ear is so elementary. It is the tone. It's also the riff. It's also the whatever he does that he does so frequently in Fall 97 that you hear it immediately in this 11-14 97 twist, and it's there. It takes you there, and it kind of reminds me of early 94 tapes. RJ and I would always hear kind of a recurrent theme from Trey, and then the middle of 95 he would have the same thing, and then here we are again in 97 where he kind of does the same thing over and over again. And it's not in a bad way. It's just this is where he is, and this is where he's comfortable, and this is kind of where he lands, maybe, or where he starts. I don't know, one or the other, or both.
There's a ritual character to a lot of, I mean, I go on about this tour all day, but there's a ritual character to a lot of the shows, and it's especially the first half of Fall 97, where I don't think of funk as a style as being very interesting for them. They're not the best at it by any stretch. It's not exactly where they live, and they learn so much from like playing along with Meters records and everything. But what funk opens up to them as far as the density that you can get playing minimalist music, you know, that's the Talking Heads all over, like half the band. At times it seems like they can barely play their instruments, but they're like, they generate this dense tangle of music. And Fish found a way to, by playing less and less, by Trey stepping back, being humble. And those are all things that are sort of built into funk that aren't, you don't necessarily need the style of funk to learn those lessons. Funk instead becomes a set of organizational principles of association between band members and between the band and the audience. And I think of the Space Jams of Fall 97 as a sort of spiraling out of that. Like they have to be in that state of sort of hushed empathy and connectedness. And then the Space Jams are like Trey stepping up to the front. And it's like he's saying, it's like a canter at a service in a way. Like it's not about ego declaration. It's about him putting a button on the experience of quiet, on the experience of mystery that everybody's having. I've gone on about this shows for years. Nobody wants any more of this shit from me.
98 and the first part of 99, it's not that there wasn't good music played, but for lack of a better term, was sort of more of the same. They were coasting along the same arc. But then Fall of 99 is probably where you see the first real shift, the significant shift in sound as they got to that spacey groove that they kept approaching, which was a little bit different than what they had been doing for the last 18 months or so. I think if anything, you could argue that maybe we should have gone with something that was a little bit earlier. But it's hard to argue with something from Big Cypress being also a kind of, you know, significant turning point of what happened. I mean, it affects the band's trajectory from that point forward. You know, it's ultimately what causes the hiatus, the first hiatus, and some, you know, kind of the first domino that fell in terms of a shift in the band's frequency of play that happened over the next few years.
We're playing a song called Drugs. That's weird.
Yeah. But I mean, this, you know, from Big Cypress, though, the moment that we picked here kind of is the encapsulation. I made reference to this before, which is the 2001. This is when the end of the Midnight to Sunrise set, when it's almost not that this jam is noteworthy for musically what it did and how it changed the band or signified change. I think it's more just the moment that when they stepped off the stage after playing this jam, things were going to be fundamentally different forever for the band. I mean, it was definitely the end of an era when they walked off stage after Big Cypress.
Like I've come to think of 2.0, so to speak, as them still casting about for an answer to the question that Big Cypress poses. And I feel like it took them 10 years to find the answer. Like they had to really start over and try to reconceive themselves. Like they had to break up because there was no continuation of the principles that they were following at the end of 1.0 that was going to give them the like spirit of discovery and freedom and joy that they used to enjoy. Like I don't listen to, I think maybe infamously, I listen to Big Cypress very often. I find parts of it a little unsatisfying to me musically. But there's no question that when they are deep in it, those hours in the wee hours of the night, those hours of music are, there's no pretense. There's no, none of the, none, there's no expectation. Like they're in a place that only they could have made at a time of night that is impossible to imagine. Like that's the same way. And they're obeying an impulse that they had since the mid 80s, like to play the long gig, and they're doing a kind of small version of it. And it's a very, very private joke that they're doing for tens of thousands of people at like the, at this moment of cosmic blah, 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 cosmic transformation or whatever. And it's clear that like the same way that New Year's 95 represents the consolidation of everything that they had been in the 90s, in the first half of the 90s and in the first, you know, 12 years as a band, Big Cypress was like everything that they had dreamt of being as a band, they were being. And stylistically, I don't think they were there at all.
So let me ask you this, Wally. Let's look at it. And I'm not a detail guy, I'm kind of like the, you know, the 10,000 foot guy. Think about 83.
You're way more high level. You're more of a high level guy.
You know, if we take a look at it from the 20,000 foot level, which is what I like to say in meetings, from 83 to, you know, 12/31/99, like is this a cohesive arc to you? There's dips and there's valleys and there's peaks and stuff like that. But so you're saying like at the end of this is kind of, they kind of had to take a break. I mean that I get that from what you just said.
Yeah. I mean, that's the, so Trey talks about, he came off stage and he was crying and he looked over at Fish and Fish is crying. And he said, they both realized we could stop now. Like we've done everything we set out to do. There's nothing, there's no idea that's bigger than this one. You know, they could have played at the Great Pyramids or whatever. But there was no, like some other band once did, I think, but you know, there was nowhere to go on a line anymore. They were going to have to get on a different curve. Like, and so, you know, I think of the band's evolution as they're oscillating. But the trend line is just getting bigger and bigger and more masterful and more closer to something that Big Cypress was the embodiment of. It was like they're entirely, it's all private. There's nobody else was playing down there. You know, it was the kind of event that only Fish could have done. It's the most Fish event they ever did. And it was the most inward turning in a way. Much more so than The Great Went or Lemon Wheeler or Clifford Ball. It was very like, it's just them in a swamp. Yeah, yeah.
So, Matt, what do you think about this? Like, you're, you know, the 95. So, to me, I see it as 91, 92, you know, all the way up to 95. It was them mastering the craft, practicing as much as they could. Trey playing as many notes as he could. And then you get away from that in 97. So how do you see that arc from, you know, the early 90s to this last 99 show?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you hit the nail on the head in terms of the early part of the 90s being this growth period. We've talked about them trying a lot of different things, learning how to be ambitious and jam on stage. In the second half of the decade, they sort of lay back and they say, okay, we don't have to be so aggro about it. We can just sort of let the music happen. We know that we're able to create it, so let's just go out and experience it and let it be a little bit more natural. And Big Cypress was maybe the culmination of all of that, where they said, let's be so absolutely comfortable You know, while I mentioned on the last episode, the band, you know, the practice rituals and the band just, you know, playing forever and having the true moment be like when the four of them are just alone creating something and experiencing that creation between the four of them. Big Cypress was maybe the best example of them really letting the audience in on that and just saying, we're going to stay up all night and we're going to play and we don't know what's going to happen. We're going to do these long things. And, you know, Fish even made the joke about it. You know, I mean, talking about, you know, whatever he said, you know, are we at a concert in front of 90,000 people at 5:30 in the morning or whatever it was at that point? I mean, what other band has done something like that? It's a completely unique experience to just go out there and not even just say, hey, we're going to play like, you know, for an hour and just improv and see what happens. And that's risky enough as it is. But to say, we're just going to do this for, we don't even know how long it's going to be. We're going to use the nature. We're going to use the sun as a guide. When it comes up, we're done. That's pretty ballsy.
I mentioned with the twist, the E-Center twist, that feeling of timelessness and that feeling of being outside of regular time and in a ritual, in the invocation of a ritual, in the moment of a theatrical performance, in any kind of magical process, as goofy as that concept is, in a magical process, the point is to suspend your experience of like linear time and of grounded sort of mundane experience and to get into a new kind of time and a new conception of space. They did that. They went to a fucking swamp and they made a city in it. And they went to a time between millennia, right? Between years is enough of a, they're in that liminal space, but then this is that times the thousand, right? They really did. It's funny. Earlier 2 weeks ago, I remember this very clearly. You mentioned in our previous episode that the UIC 94 Divided Sky is the moment that Trey mentions on the Charlie Rose interview as he was asked, what are the peak moments? And he mentions that. But he also mentions any time it was the four of us in a practice room. That's his other peak moment. And he says, I know it sounds like a cop out, but anytime it's just the four of us, that's when we're most at our, and so the UIC Divided Sky, like what he says, he felt something in the room and he starts playing a solo, going through every part of the improv except for actually playing the notes. And he said the crowd erupted. There's nothing for them to hear, but they felt it. And so Big Cypress is the four of them playing alone in a swamp in the most isolated, like one of the most isolated parts of the country. It just happens that there are 70,000 people are there feeding into them and feeding off of them. But it's a totally private experience in an environment that they've made that is intimate and public and private and celebratory and elegiac and everything all at once. There's nothing left that moment doesn't contain. And that's, yeah. They just and so I figure they kind of had to stop after that, and because there's nothing new in 2003 and 2004 in their music particularly.
So to look at the list, I think the next one thing that we defined as a turning point at the beginning of 2.0, we talked about this Nassau Tweezer. This is another one that it's not necessarily that the jam signifies a change in musical direction or anything like that, because they sort of after. Big Cypress in the late 90s, they sort of continued along the same sort of rock and roll / jazz trajectory, keeping a relatively consistent jam. There's these micro things that pop up like the Plinkos and things like that. But this Tweezer, I think we called out for being probably the point in 2.0 when sort of air quotes, they're back, right? You know, it was the first big significant jam that people kind of got excited about Fish, because yeah, there was a lot of excitement about the band when they came back, but that the New Year's run and the first couple weeks of that winter tour were fine, but I think there was a feeling of like, you know, are they the same band? They had this time off, are they rusty or whatever? And this is a really, really fantastic classic Tweezer, up with some of the greats, that you could say was a sign that like, no, we've still got it. We needed to warm up a little bit.
So I think we got to give honorable mention to the gin from 222,
which is 03. Good. Yeah.
Yeah, this late February 03 run is pretty solid.
And then to talk about it in 2004, as you said, I actually am looking at the list now and I'm saying we did talk about having one of those Vegas shows on there. I think that was the one that made the recommendation around that. Because as painful as it is, that was a turning point. Those shows really resulted in the breakup. You had the sloppy play, the feedback that they saw from the Jesse Gerno piece that really kind of stirred the pot. And that was direct causation of the breakups. That's a significant turning point there. I think the problem that we had with that was, I mean, what clip do you pick or what jam do you talk about? It was just sort of a disappointing period that unfortunately was probably the band's rock bottom. Here, so let me ask you a brief kind of sidebar question. Do you think that the Vegas shows or Coventry was worse?
Oh, I don't think I've ever been able to. I've never been able to listen to either in their entirety, and they're all. It's all the Coventry's so overwritten with emotional sort of metatext that it's hard to. It's hard, impossible for me to evaluate its music. So I remember Charlie used to recommend Charlie Dirksen, Esquire,
he used to recommend, who I finally got to have a couple of years, maybe years ago, I like had lunch with here in Boston. He lives in the area now. And it just felt like it was nice. Finally, he was a human being instead of just an avatar of hateful, jaded nonsense. Like, it turns out he's just this kind of sweet, tall, awkward guy. He's like me, but sweet and tall.
shout out to Charlie Dirksen, where I think we're going to find out whether or not he listens to the show when this comes out.
He's just a swell guy. And it was so nice to stitch together in another way, a part of a community that had been so dear to me for 20 years. But he used to go on about the split open and melt or the bag from Coventry. And I want to be able to listen to it as music, but I can't. Like, every time I visit it, it's like the millionth episode of a TV show, and it's all binding together all the previous episodes. It's like an element of a serial narrative to me, and I can't hear it as a standalone episode. So like the Waiting in the Velvet Sea that they played at Coventry, I realized at some point is actually kind of great. Like, there's something about it that's kind of great. There's a rawness to it. Yeah, but it's that's inseparable from the calamitous speech that they give, right? And so, and that split, I think if Trey hadn't introduced the split as, it's not, so the crowd starts to go a little nuts when Trey says, we need to blow off a little steam. We need to blow off some fucking steam. And the crowd goes nuts. And so I don't know how many people actually heard what he said after that. What he said, because it's the scariest thing I'd ever heard him say. He said, because I keep looking at the clock. And he can't finish the sentence. He's crying again. And it's like being by somebody's deathbed. That to me is the most harrowing moment of the entire thing. And I just have no interest in hearing Coventry as music.
Is they see it coming, the impending death that they've brought upon themselves, right? And it's just terrible, especially when he's repeating himself night after night or whatever. Like, it's just not enjoyable.
And I think it's legitimate to experience it in those purely emotional terms and not be able to, like, I don't think it was a critical failing or an analytical failing.
I don't think it's like, I'm not discounting their emotion. I'm like discounting, like, there's some like little gems in there, some minutes of good music, but sure. Generally you can't like go back there and say, it's enjoyable.
Yeah. And no, I guess the point I'm trying to make is I don't think anybody should feel obligated to like take off their emotionally connected to the band hat and put on their critic hat when it comes to that. Like, it's okay. You don't ever have to have equanimity and objectivity about like your ex-husband's new wife. Like, you don't ever have to like her. It's okay. You're not obligated to. You're allowed to hate her. That's your lot in life. Like, you earned it. And I'm allowed to feel totally fucked up when it comes to Coventry.
I think we've dwelled in the negativity too much. Let's get to Brighter Pastures in 3.0.
Yeah.
Yes.
Impending death.
I would call this like the rebirth, this next year.
Yes. Right? So tell us about the rebirth.
This is 1128 Fred's album called Jazzin' Around.
Jazzin' Around. This is the closing track.
That Albany show?
Yeah, 09 is the second night of two nights, right?
Yeah.
It's the opener of the second set.
Uh-huh. It was the only fall 09 show I went to.
So tell me, I mean, this is like, for me, 7 minutes in was, okay, here we are. And then there's even this little segment of Paige trying to play the Ghost intro. And everybody's like, whoa, bro, like, we're not there yet. Like, let's fucking jam some more. And it's 22 plus 25 minutes of, you know, the opening two songs, the second set. Just amazing. Thank you.
I'm reading Neuromancer again for the first time in many years. It's one of my favorite books from my teenage years. And it's actually the book that, coined, if memory served, coins the term cyberspace and the phrase the Matrix to refer to the internet. And it's about like a cyberspace cowboy who's been fried by some like horrifying, you know, neurotoxin. He can't get into cyberspace anymore. And he's hired by some bad dudes to do some crimes for them. And they get him, they fix him. They perform a surgery. And so he is finally able to like jack into cyberspace for the first time, but he's terrified. And so the first day that he does it, like his description of him like returning to the environment that he used to think of as inextricable from himself. Gibson describes him as like saying, sort of quietly saying to himself, please now. And it's not clear if he's saying it to himself or to the universe. And then he describes him as tears of release streaming down his face as he like re-enters this kind of, he's able to leave the prison of himself and be now infinite. He'd just be a mind. And the seventh minute of that jam in Albany, that's exactly what everyone in the room, I think, felt. It was, I remember saying, please, just let it go. Let us go. And Laurie and I remember like we're hugging each other and jumping up and down and screaming like in each other's faces because we couldn't believe that they had finally stepped out of themselves.
You know, RJ, I mean? Was there, and I remember him telling me probably on the 29th day of November that like, holy shit, man, you know, like here it is. So
it was so awesome. It was so great.
Yeah.
It was the moment we knew that everything was going to be okay and Fish was going to keep jamming forever.
Yeah. I remember it felt like a huge exhale after that happened. There was so much anxiety that went away. And not that everything got immediately back to like 97 levels of playing or anything like that, but it was, as you know, with the tweezer from Nassau that we just talked about in 2003, it was a sign after the break that like, no, don't you worry. We haven't lost anything. It's just a matter of if and when. So I wasn't at that show, but I remember breathing a huge sigh of relief after that happened, that, you know, they really were the same band when they wanted to be.
So talk about the next one that we talked or that we chose, which is from Watkins Glen, right? July 3rd, 2011, the Storage Jam.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of years later, well, almost 2 years later, there's good music in between. August 2010, specifically at the Greek, I think are great shows. Trey's got the new guitar, the Koa special piece that, you know, Languedoc saved for him. But the Storage Jam is a highlight. I think it's a turning point. And why do you think that?
Well, it was not just a great jam, but a new sound, a new set of experimentation. The band's gear was like drastically altered that night. They were playing through completely different equipment, which is kind of the, you know, mother of necessity at that point, because they, if you think about it, all of their main gear is on the main stage at the festival at that point. They have to have some sort of like side gear or backup gear ready to go for them to play an hour later on a stealth set, which, side note, I think contributed to the drive-in jam as well. But the Storage Jam in particular, they were using a lot of weird equipment. Trey was experimenting with delays that he hadn't experimented with before. There was some instrument switching that happened. So, you know, they were playing, and I think Fish, I don't even think Fish had a real kit for that. I think he had like a Roland synth kit or something like that that he was playing. So it was a very, very different sound. If you were there, were you guys all at Super Bowl? Did you experience the same?
No, I'm not. That was not super for me.
So I was the only one there. So they also, like in this ball square where they had it, they had a quadraphonic sound system. So there was this PA stacks really far away and a diamond around you when you stood in this area where all these fake buildings were. And the whole time they were panning all the instruments all around the crowd that had gathered while they were playing. But also it gives a cool effect because if you were standing really close to one set of speakers, you just kind of got a ton of that. And the other one, you know, elements sounded very distant. But things were swirling around and stuff like that. And so it was a big departure from anything that they had done, before, even some of the other late night sets. It was very, very like odd sounding, not necessarily melodic at times, sometimes based purely on just rhythms of delays and synths and things like that. And I think that, that's important because it showed a commitment to continued, forward progress. You know, from the band at this, you know, kind of late era in their career. So many bands become legacy bands and they just coast along on doing the same thing. And they said, no, you know, we're going to put a stake in the ground. We're still going to do new, crazy, experimental things. You can expect that from us moving forward. So I think that's why this this jam definitely makes the list.
Maybe a lot of credit goes to Mike. I don't know. He seems to be the one thinking outside of the box. I mean, obviously Trey's the driving force behind everybody, but... Mike's always got a little different take on stuff and maybe sound. Who knows? I don't know.
Matt, do you remember, were they out of sight for that jam?
Yeah, so they were in, what it was like they had set up this fake, it almost looked like a Wild West area where there was just like a bunch of fake buildings. And one of them was a storage unit. Uh-huh. And they opened up part of it, if my memory is serving correctly, but it still had this very like opaque kind of glass over it. So the most you could see at any point was like their shadows kind of bouncing up because there was lights inside that were illuminating them from inside. Uh-huh. So you'd see, Trey's shadow kind of like pass across the building. It was very, very psychedelic.
So interesting. Cause I'm thinking about the big sort of transitional moments in 3.0. And I think about the Ball Square Jam. And the drive-in jam, if memory serves, is all they're similarly like obscured. And then there's the thrilling chilling set when they're in costume, right? They're in face paint and they're playing like in a stage set. And they can sort of turn inward. And then there's the set. I'm trying to think the New Year's 2013 set, like And so in like there are times when I think it does them a lot of good to efface themselves. Like I think of The Blob as exactly that kind of experiment, and Surrender to the Air, again, announcing its intention as being that kind of thing, as they don't seek out the spotlight. They don't have that instinct. I think they don't have that instinct in the crass way that like you can hear in Hoist how uncomfortable they are making an LA kind of album. Like Hoist is kind of shitty because it sounds like they're trying. I think the way I've described it in the past is they're trying to please the wrong people. The reason I bring these examples up is that like I think they need sometimes in order to really push forward, it seems like they need to erase themselves and they need to make themselves small or invisible even.
Or look at each other. The feeling exactly. Chilling, they're all facing each other. And I think that little square that they made, and we probably talked about it, it seems to create something.
Yep. So this,
they did that with the Tower Jam where you couldn't see them at all. It was a complete, the visual representation was sick. They were all on, the tower itself.
They all stood on each other's shoulders. And they were like 12.
So, all right, guys, we're going on. We're moving on. We know that the jams behind Opaque Glass are amazing. We are on number 13 of our, what we identified as a 15.
Holy sort
of,
shit.
Yeah, yes. 30 points.
this is it. Oh, this is it for me. This is it
for Brad.
Yeah.
This is it for Brad. Go ahead, Brad. I don't want to steal your thunder, bro.
No, this is the Fuck Your Face show, not set, because, you know, they take it into the second set. But this Undermine from 8/31/2012 from Dix. I mean, this is, we were new to our house that I currently live in. I had just my phone.
Oh boy, here we go.
Yeah.
Personal history.
Just my phone. And I hit the Live Fish. I didn't stream it or whatever. And then I was listening to it. And I'm like, oh, this is cute. Like, whatever, this whole Fuck You first set. And the Undermine came on, and it took me away, man. Like, this is, I don't know what it is. I listen to it a lot. We listen to it just in the house. It's Mike's bass, which kind of dominates for a long time. Fish's cowbell, the whole thing, man. I think it
legitimately just changed everything. For real.
It's just incredible. I love everything about it. Everything about it.
Thank you.
So what was important about this, though?
To me, this was a new, this was a new, like, this was where 3.0 really, like, became original and new. It was, like, new soundscapes. I don't know. I hadn't heard jamming like this before. And the fact that it was so, it was, on one hand, like, it was, you know, Type 2, whatever, and Undermined is was an interesting song for that to happen with that whole first set. I mean, you could pick anything from that first set, and they were all like that. The Carini, the Kill Devil Falls, the
I mean, even the Uncle Pen, right?
Yeah, it was just cool. It was all good, but I think the Undermine, like the rhythm and the groove that comes out of it, is something unlike anything I've ever heard before from Phish.
So I think one of the differences too is there's so much of the build, you know, in the peak and then the bliss or whatever, like, you know, however it comes, this doesn't have it. It's just kind of a 15 minute jam of rhythm, right? Like kind of the cowbell and Mike and Phish, the dominate. And then, you know, there's builds in it, obviously, but it's different than even what we hear today.
It's rhythm groove, but it's also like majestic and beautiful at the same time. It's a wonderful piece of music.
If you chart backwards from where we are now, and most people acknowledge in the last few years, there have been really, really elevated levels of playing over the first part of 3.0. It starts with that Dick's Run, and really in particular this show, where suddenly, with every show, you saw an advancement in the band's sound and jamming to the level that you had not seen for quite some time before that. So I think that to me is why this is definitely a turning point, literally, if you were to chart it out.
Yeah, I think the Undermined also reminds me a lot of the Camden Chalk Dust from 99. I mean, it's, I don't know if it's just the kind of where Trey's guitar ends up, or whatever, which we didn't include the Chalk Dust from Camden. So congratulations to us, because I like to talk about that a lot. But I don't know, there's something that's like very, and like Providence Bowie falls in the same category for me, which is like very organic majesty. That's the category. And those three things fall into that category.
Nice.
Wally, what's your take?
I think, I suspect that they are really at ease, perversely at ease, when they set themselves a kind of ridiculous challenge. The Clifford Ball is an example of that. I think of Big Cypress as sort of the classic example of that, but like playing the White Album is also an example of that. Jesus. Well, yeah. The Baker's Dozen ends up being the biggest such challenge, and this is a preview of the Baker's Dozen, of the jam filled night, because they basically say we have no if we're going to do this gag, we have no choice but to really explore in improvisation, meaning that we have to count on our jamming like to carry us, in a way that they kind of implicitly do from night to night, but now it was. The menu for tonight is we are going to play engaging improvisations in only 12 songs, and it's going to get us through 3 hours of music. Like that's an absurd thing for a bunch of 50-year-olds to demand of themselves.
You know, when they present themselves with something to do, a task, are they better? Right. Well, yeah. The Fuck Your Face set shows that. The Baker's Dozen shows that. Like, I think it's an easy answer, I think.
Well, let's sorry, go ahead, Wally.
No, it's all right.
I want to just say that the last two, actually, not to jump ahead, but Tahoe Tweezer also was that, I think, based on the lore of, you know, the story about our friend Kevin, who talked to Fishman at a bar, and he was talking about Mud Island, which we talked about last episode, and how that was the last long Tweezer, et cetera. And then the next night they played the Tahoe Tweezer. So that seemed to have been some sort of setup as well. Not as public as the others, but that seems to be the theme now. So it seems like they always need a gag from now on to play turning points. So we should tell them. Should email them right now and tell them.
You've discounted it now. You call it a gag.
Well, I mean a challenge. Sorry, challenge.
I think they need some grit to it. So, you know, it's interesting that it's not at all a coincidence that their big improvisatory vehicles for the longest time were songs like You Enjoy Myself and Reba and David Bowie. And these are songs where they spend several minutes, in the case of Yem, it's like 10 minutes, syncing up, playing really hard music. And the music is so hard that it erases their, it's got to just be in your fingers. Like you can't be in your ego. You can't be actively thinking through what you're going to play. You just have to have it down cold. And it's a test. It's like taking a math test at high speed in front of 10,000 people who paid money to see you take it and demand that you ace it. And expect you, because they've heard the tapes of 100 other math tests you took, they expect you to ace it. And they're going to be a little irritated if you do. And then at the end of that, they get to float. That's it. I go on about it. It's algebraic. Like their music, their compositions, Trey's compositions are very schematic and algebraic at times, especially early in his career. And they do that in order that everybody there is synced up. It's like listening to those brainwave syncing tapes at night. The point is to get once you're all in a pure... Oh, people... Okay. But like, once everybody's brain is a pure sinusoid, I've never done it. Like that's the state they want everybody to be in so that they can be totally receptive to the background noise of the universe, right? It becomes discernible as noise atop the synchronized wave that everybody's on. And so what that means is that they were at their best improv-wise, not starting cold in an okipa ceremony, which is a lot of fucking dumb noodling most of the time. But instead, it's when they set themselves the challenge of nailing this and nailing these hard songs and seeding themselves with musical ideas, right? Because they're analytical types. And so when late in their career, so much good comes out of themselves setting, it comes out of them setting themselves a hard task and having to, they need an occasion to rise to. Yeah, and they do so well when the pressure is off. But I mean, they need that pressure. They need the pump prime, and that's
they're creative people, and they want creative challenges, for sure.
So here's what that I'm realizing about the Tahoe Tweezer too, besides its length and importance. When else has the audience influenced the course of a jam?
Sure.
It's very obvious that when the audience started wooing, that gave Trey an idea, and that probably fueled about the last 13 minutes or so of the jam. I'm struggling to think of times when that's happened, where something that the audience did affected the band, not just, you know, fueled them, but like affected them in terms of like, whoa, we have to play, because they could have wrapped up the Tweezer at 23 minutes and it would have been a great Tweezer and people would have been like, yeah, cool, Tahoe Tweezer. But the band, the audience starts the wooing, it fuels this idea, and that leads to an entire additional long section. I think it's worth noting.
There's really a long, or not long, but like there's a continuing baiting by the band after that, where they're like, oh, here, let's get them to woo, right? I mean, it's almost like they brought it on later on, and fans were bitching about it, but it, you know, the band was kind of egging the crowd on with it. So,
man, it stuck around for years too. But you're right, Matt. I think there haven't been that many instances of that. And the, you know, as we kind of wind toward Baker's Dozen, I mean, it's in a lot of ways.
What about the hood from what was it, Red Rocks, when they first, you know, Harry Hood?
Yeah, and the Art Jam that we talked about last time. That's, I mean, it's interesting because I think not to like make this too grandiose, but it seems like all the stuff we've talked about over the past two episodes, there's like elements of everything in Baker's Dozen, which is why this conversation originally started. But you go back to what we were talking about last time with the segues from the Bomb Factory and the kind of pure sort of improv of 94-95 exploratory stuff, and the fan element and the engagement that we've been talking about in this episode, like this, I don't know, the Storage Jam and even the Tahoe Tweezer. And a lot of that to me is really reflected in the Baker's Dozen, because we as fans were a huge part of it. You know, it wasn't just the donuts and whatever. It was the fact that we were all there at the same time for so many nights in a row. I mean, not all of us were there every night, but like, I think that was a big part of it. Right. And the challenges piece, that they obviously challenged themselves to kind of, you know, no repeats and all that. I don't know. It's kind of a combination of a lot of the stuff we've talked about over the past couple episodes.
Yeah. So here's what I would say, because getting back to the beginning of this whole discussion, I believe it started with the Baker's Dozen Lawn Boy and a question about how important is this in the grand scheme of things. So I guess what I would ask is defend it. You know, why is the Baker's Dozen Lawn Boy this great jam that was just played? That is the freshest example of anything we're talking about. Why is that so important?
So I'll start and be brief, but I think to me it's more from a fan perspective and not necessarily from a musical perspective. I think it shows that any song can be a vehicle for classic improv, and I think we've gotten used to since 2013, really, of like, you know, what's the second set thing going to be? It's going to be Down with Disease if I go. Right. If I don't go, it'll be Tweezer or something else. but you know, we've gotten used to this formula almost of like, you know, there might be a 46 Days or Walls of the Cave at the end of the first set, or an Antelope if we're lucky, and then we'll have like a cool first two songs of the second set, maybe a second set closer, but they'll like fumble in the fourth quarter, whatever the analogy is. And, you know, I think this just broke the formula. I think this broke the mold for 3.0. And
sure,
whether it happens again or not, it doesn't really matter. It's a completely new and novel. It's a completely novel concept. And I think it changed everyone's perspective on what's possible with Phish music. That's my take anyway.
my thought to it's kind of similar, RJ, that excuse me, they were at the Baker's Dozen very, very, very good at bringing the place to an eruption, like every night, right? I wasn't there for all 13, but like they could take any song and kind of build it, and the place would go crazy, and the lights and the whole thing was just amazing. Mm-hmm. But they didn't get into a rut where they just did it in the second set or whatever. They could have fallen into like a, look, we're not repeating any songs, but like, you better believe the second set, we're just going to make this place explode. They kind of showed us in the, this night with the Lawn Boy, that like, look, we can still do whatever we want, even though we're very adept at doing the stuff that makes everybody go crazy. I guess that, yeah.
I think I'm going to present the minority report here, and I'm going to say that for the last turning point, I would not have selected anything from the Baker's Dozen at all. I would have selected the Fare Thee Well shows as the most important thing that's happened to Phish since they came back, maybe. Because Trey finally had Trey of the 90s in his hands for the first time since the 90s. It was the feeling that I had, and I think he was more himself finally. But leave that aside, I think the Lawn Boy is, when they played, they jammed out Sample at first. I hate the phrase jammed out, and if my wife would be embarrassed to hear me say it, and my son would roll his eyes, and he's only 7. But they sort of stretched out Sample, and everybody sort of knew that that was going to be that was what was going to happen. Like that they'd sort of said jam filled, and we sort of knew the conceit. And it's not the world's greatest jam or anything. It's just, hey, they stretched out Sample fucking finally. And it felt like a punchline a little bit, but they get to Lawn Boy and it's a novelty song, and they've stretched out novelty songs before. I mean, Makisupa is a novelty song, for God's sake. And they're half their songs are arguably novelty songs. They extraordinarily beautiful. Yeah. I mean, they played extraordinarily beautiful versions of Fee, and Fee is a silly, joke tune. But yeah, they built Wipeout into a set long improvisation. Right. So, but they're, they get to Lawn Boy and it just feels like, all bets are off, but it's not only in the way that the Fuck Your Face show sort of forced them to play these long jams. They really, like, a half hour is a goddamn long time to play this song, and it's not boring for even a second. They're just fully invested and at ease. They're not nervous. Like the Sample jam is a little bit like, oh, look what we're doing. They're self-conscious, a little self-conscious. They're drawing attention to it. The Lawn Boy jam is just like, he puts on that stupid guitar because why not? And they just go. And the entire jam is just like, why not? And the entire show is just like, why not? And the entire run feels just, why not? We can do anything. There never again in our lives needs to be pressure on this music. Because everything that we've been doing it for 30 years, we can just accept like we're an institution. And so what's an awesome thing you can do as an institution is just play something as stupid as this. We're going to play Lawn Boy forever.
So I'll round up by giving the answer to my own question. I'll suggest that the book is not written on the Lawn Boy yet. It only happened 3 months ago. And what we've seen as we've talked about all these jams over the last two episodes, it's not necessarily about what happened that night. It's about what happened afterwards. And time will tell if the Baker's Dozen Lawn Boy is something that is a turning point in Phish's history, or if it was just a moment where they played a great jam. And I think that we have a lot of time to go to see that. And maybe we'll look back in a year, 2 years, 5 years, and we'll be able to reassess that. But right now we have sort of a hanging Chad number 15 is the Baker's Dozen Lawn Boy. It not only is this still Lawn Boy, but is Lawn Boy important?
Interesting. Wow. Nice. That's a fucking curveball for you. So we don't even know I mean, this the whole thing started with Loneboy. Now Matt's telling us that we don't know yet.
Well,
this is sort of like this is sort of like the ending of like Lost or something, where they're like you're like waiting for some big ending, and they're like, actually, maybe it never happened.
We were all dead. I don't know.
But also,
God damn it.
That's it's like we're gonna tell you the answer at the end, but really we're just gonna piss you off. That's what we just did.
Actually, no. Don't stop believing, people.
So anyway, we're back for 123 sometime.
This is the end of The Sopranos, where you don't know if Brad shot me or not. Wally, as we wrap up, is there any sort of brief kind of takeaway from you from going through these two episodes and just going back and kind of thinking about this topic?
I think there have been moments throughout the last both of these episodes when the our trying to account for the music means trying to account for shifts in our perspective about the music. And one of the things over the years that I've tried to become more sanguine about people like ranking and rating shows, because the purpose of the exercise isn't to generate a ranking. Those are all useless. It's to generate a state of mind like that you can only get to after a long period of sort of thinking stuff through and talking it through. And so I think you could probably pick 10 other shows that are in other ways like big turning points for the band and for the community. And I would note actually that the more and more as we got toward the end, like especially in tonight's episode, there are the moments of transition have a lot to do with the community's relationship with the band. And the blurring of the lines between band and the universe that they've made. And that's a sign in a way of how successful like their long-term project of making a tiny space for themselves to move and breathe freely amongst beloved friends, right? That's always been their project from the sculpture garden at Goddard to Madison Square Garden. And so I take them literally and seriously when they say the life they love is, you know, making music with their friends. Like that's they borrowed an actual good lyricist's words to get to something simple and almost banal sounding and perfectly true for them. And so the I think it's okay that the exercise of like thinking through all this stuff ends up, I don't think it's quite history or historiography. I think it's just kind of in throwing a little light on dusty corners of like our relationship to them and to one another. Like that's, I guess what I'm trying to say is I'm very grateful to have had the chance to share this kind of this path with you guys. I don't think it has to have produced anything. And I'm okay with the fact that we don't know. I think it's perfect that we don't know how significant Lawn Boys is, because its significance is the least significant thing about it.
Awesome. Brad, your follow-up album to Jazzing Around is going to be Dusty Corners.
Dusty Corners of Jazz.
No, Jazzy. Yeah. Wally, I just want to say when we started talking about this topic, there's no better person to go through this exercise with. So thank you for sharing all your wisdom. But
totally.
Brad, what's your wisdom?
I don't have it, dude. Come on. What am I supposed to do? Follow what Wally said? Get the fuck out of here.
Matt?
What he said. No, this has been, this seriously though, this has been fun. I think it's it was a good topic. It was thought provoking. It actually like resulted in a lot more back and forth than the listeners probably know about in advance of the recording and everything like that. So I hope everybody, nobody's going to agree. I mean, so fuck that. But I mean, I hope people have thoughts about it at least, and will add us and contact us, email us, you know, send up smoke signals, whatever. Tell us how wrong we are, and let's get into it.
Add us,
you know,
add us, bros. It's this bros. So Wally, thank you for joining. Wally is at Waxed Banks on Twitter. And if you haven't read either and both of Wally's books, a live one from 33 and a third. Did I say that right, Brad?
Wally? Yeah, Wally, that's his name.
In a tiny space to move and breathe, which is about Fall 97. Wally, will you come back again and talk to us more about Fish?
Oh, I'd love to. That's This is always a genuine treat. Thank you.
And Matt, Brad, thank you guys. This has been fun. We miss Jonathan.
Yeah, I was going to say that. Nice.
But Jonathan and Brad can't be in the same internet room, so keep picking and choosing. All right, guys. Well, thanks, everyone, for listening. Have a good week. Keep on rocking.